Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, so we are bringing you a Vault episode. This one originally aired on October 4th, 2022. It's part two of our series on Elf Shot. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our series on Elf Shot. Now, this is an idea we introduced in part one. If you haven't listened to that yet, you should go back, check that one out first. But basically, Elf Shot is a, what would you say, Rob? Like, it's a complex of interlocking folk beliefs, not a single belief, but it's found especially in the British Isles. And essentially centering on the idea of fairies or elves attacking mortal humans and especially their livestock with supernatural weapons. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. There's a lot going on in it, as we discussed in the first episode. I mean, on one hand, there's the interpretation of artifacts, from various time periods, both ancient and relatively recent. There's also the attempt to understand mysterious ailments, mostly in livestock, but sometimes in human beings as well. And then various folk traditions getting wrapped up into these scripts. And it's also, it seems to be highly regional too. There's not just one elf arrow script. We have multiple scripts. It ends up tying into folk medicine and so forth as well.
Yeah, and that folk medicine aspect is very interesting. I want to come back to that in just a minute. So in the last episode, we did talk about some direct accounts of folk beliefs about Elf Shot, especially in Scotland, I think is where a lot of these accounts came from. And they included things like, okay, you'd have a story where a calf suddenly falls ill and dies with no apparent explanation. And then the farmer confirms that Elf Shot was the cause because he and his neighbor open up the cow's body and they find a hole in its heart, even though there was no hole in the hide. So it must have been some kind of supernatural fairy weapon that can pierce through the hide without actually breaking it and strike only the internal organs. And then, of course, when it was believed that there was an injury of this kind caused by an elf or a fairy weapon, there were plenty of magical remedies. And Rob, can you characterize what some of the main themes in these remedies were?
Yeah, some of the main themes included, of course, being able to fetch either the elf arrow or have an elf arrow that you found, or elf arrows that were in the possession of the town or local community, and using those in the treatment. Oftentimes, this would take the form of immersing them in water and then using that water either as a drink for the afflicted or as something that is rubbed on the afflicted or poured on the site of the wounding, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there are a number of different versions of this, and so various wrinkles get added depending on which tradition you're looking at and which account.
Yeah, other things were just like, oh, hey, mix up some gunpowder with some eggs and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and then feed that to the cow.
Right.
Delicious. But anyway, I wanted to address a question that came up while we were talking last time. I didn't have the answer to it at the time, so I decided to look it up before we recorded this episode. And the question is there such a thing as the placebo effect for non-human animals? Of course, the placebo effect in humans is something that often comes up when we're talking about, talking about medicine in any context, but it's especially important when you're talking about like the history of pre-scientific medicine. Like, why did people think that soaking a stone arrowhead in water and then pressing it to their skin had actually healed them of a disease? Like, if you have a tumor or a bacterial infection or something, we can be relatively confident that this intervention does not actually shrink the tumor or kill the bacteria. And yet people often thought interventions like this had healed them. So what made them think that? I think some of that can be chalked up to a concept that we did an episode about, I think last year it was, a statistical phenomenon called regression toward the mean or regression to the mean. But you can also think of this concept as returning to the baseline. So as a quick explainer for that, imagine you suddenly get a pain in your foot and you've never had that pain before. And you're like, it really hurts. I don't know what to do. But your friend says, well, I know what to do. You have to sing a Gregorian chant, and then you have to lick the morning dew from a spider's web. So you try that out. You want your foot to stop hurting. And then what do you know? Sometime after that, your foot does stop hurting. Now, in a situation like this, we really all have a tendency to think something has been proved here. Like, the spider dew did work. But actually, how do you know that your foot wouldn't have stopped hurting on its own just as soon if you didn't do any of that stuff? In fact, the whole point is that your foot doesn't usually hurt. The state of pain is an outlier. That's an anomalous condition. So things going back to normal on a certain time scale is a totally expected outcome, all things being equal. And regression to the mean is especially important in medicine because it tends to be specifically when we're in an anomalous condition, a condition that is not normal for us, that we seek medical interventions. So if you want to know if a medical intervention actually works or not, you have to compare its efficacy against a placebo control group instead of just giving somebody a treatment and saying, did you get better? If you do that, you don't know if they would have gotten better anyway. Having the comparison between the two groups gives you confidence in the efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
But on top of just the regression to the mean as a baseline effect, you've also got psychological effects where if you actually compare people who receive an intervention like a medicine or a ritual or a doctor's visit versus people who don't receive any intervention, sometimes people who receive an intervention have better outcomes on average, even if there's no way that intervention is actually doing anything. If it's like, pressing the arrowhead to your skin, this might be considered the pure placebo effect, improved outcomes associated with an intervention, even though it's not doing anything mechanistically or chemically to solve the problem. And though the placebo effect shows up for a range of conditions and treatments, it seems to be especially powerful for conditions that are modulated by the brain, such as the perception of pain and other types of discomfort. So to bring it back to the question of elf-shot cattle, could it be possible that a non-human animal benefits from the placebo effect of a magical cure in some way, even though they can't understand the concept of medicine or develop expectations that the magical cure would heal them? The thing I was wondering about with this is there's evidence that some placebo effects in humans are created not so much by the expectation that the treatment is efficacious, but by the reassurance felt in the presence of a doctor or nurse who has a good bedside manner. And I thought, well, maybe it's possible that animals could be calmed or soothed by certain kinds of human attention, even if they're not able to understand that it is for the intended purpose of healing. So anyway, I went looking this up, and I found an interesting article by Emily Anthes, who is also the author of a book we've talked about on the show before called The Great Indoors. It's all about the effects of living and spending time indoors. But this was an article published in The Atlantic in 2019 called A Crucial Blind Spot in Veterinary Medicine. So the top line answer here is a clear yes. There is such a thing as the placebo effect in non-human animals in veterinary medicine, but it probably works by different means than the human version of the placebo effect. So here's an example. Anthes begins by talking about a particular study of treatments for canine epilepsy in dogs. This research was being carried out in the early 2000s. I think this was in the year 2003. And the citation here is the Journal of Veterinary Medicine. The article was called Placebo Effect in Canine Epilepsy Trials. And the authors were Munyana, Zhang, and Patterson, eventually published in 2010. And the story is that the researchers were testing an anticonvulsant drug called levetiracetam, and it was intended to curtail epileptic seizures in dogs. So in the test group, the group that was actually getting the drug, 86% of dogs of their owners reported a reduction in seizure frequency, which bodes very well for the drug. Mm-hmm. But then the study also happened to have a placebo control group, which were receiving a dummy treatment that was supposed to do nothing. And in that group, 79% also saw a reduction in reported seizures.
79 compared to 86. That's impressive.
Right. Well, it would tend to make you doubt that the test group is, that it's actually the drug that is making the difference. So at the time of this study, Anthes notes that the double-blind placebo-controlled trials were not all that common in veterinary medicine, which makes sense on one hand, because again, like non-human animals are not thought to be able to develop expectations about a drug treatment or the efficacy of medicine. So how could you expect a placebo effect to exist in dogs? But it's a good thing the study did use such a controlled design, because otherwise the medicine would have looked really good until you realize that fake medicine leads to results that look about the same or almost as good.
I guess it's just the healing power of pill pockets, right?
My God, you can never doubt those things stink so much, and dogs love them. What do they put in those things? Do you work at a pill pocket factory? Maybe we don't want to know what goes in a pill pocket. That would be, that's Halloween content.
I have not had a good run with feline pill pockets.
I'm sorry.
And not to say they don't, you know, they work in some cats, and some cats are not crazy about them. My cat will spit it out and then like dissect it. And some brands of pill pockets, she just doesn't want a piece of anyway. She's like, no, not eating that. So,
do you ever use the trick? This worked for us in the past, where if the animal is skeptical of the pill pocket with the pill in it, you first have to give them an empty pill pocket that has no pill in it, so they get used to like, oh yeah, I can just eat this straight up. And then the second one or the third one you give them, I mean, that's a lot of pill pockets if you're stacking it up. But if you're desperate, you can try the empty pill pocket first to lower their defenses.
Well, you'd think that would work, but we ended up using the water syringe to just blast it into the back of her throat. And that seems to work well. Again, and that's a method that's not going to work for every cat either. So it's tough getting the meds in these animals sometimes.
Oh, and I should also note that, so the main study Anthes is talking about here in this article is in dogs, but she also cites studies that have reported placebo effects in cats and in horses. So anyway, how on earth could this be? Like, again, we're assuming that dogs themselves are not developing expectations that a drug will be effective. I think that's a very fair assumption. They don't understand what's going on. How on earth could such a strong placebo effect manifest? And a number of ideas are discussed in this article. One is one we already talked about, regression to the mean, right? People are more likely to enroll in a clinical trial for their dog's epilepsy if seizures have been especially bad lately, and conditions like epilepsy tend to sort of wax and wane on their own anyway. So, you know, you could enroll the dog at a time when their seizures are bad, and then that would just tend to, by the law of averages, give way to a period where they return to the baseline and have fewer seizures. Hmm. So, again, a good reason to have a placebo control group to compare your test group to. Second thing that I thought was interesting, Anthes cites something called the Hawthorne effect, which is the idea that people often behave differently when they know they're being studied or observed. I think the name of this effect comes from some anecdote about industrial productivity research, which found all kinds of spurious effects for things like, oh, what would happen if we change the lighting in this room? Are workers more productive? Oh, it turns out they are. But then one ex post facto explanation for all these spurious results is just that when employees know that they're part of an experiment, they are more productive because they know they're being closely scrutinized. Hmm. Now, this would not apply so much to the dogs themselves, but probably to the owners. So in the case of the epilepsy study in dogs, Anthes writes that that all of the dogs in the study were already on at least one other anti-seizure medication, and the levetiracetam was being studied as a supplemental drug. So one possibility is that once enrolled in a study, pet owners may have been more consistent about making sure their dogs got all doses of their pre-existing, pre-tested epilepsy medication on time. Other possible explanations. What about more attentive veterinary care? It's possible that while enrolled in the study, the animals were getting special attention from vets, and this would be partially in line with the explanation I was guessing about beforehand. Something roughly parallel to the effect of a reassuring doctor or nurse. And I think it is a pre-existing finding that sometimes gentle, affectionate attention from humans can help animals like dogs and horses show fewer symptoms of discomfort or anxiety and things like that. In some cases, you could actually have classical conditioning. Probably it's hard to see how it would apply to this case, but Anthes writes, quote, "For example, rats that have regularly been getting insulin injections will still experience blood sugar changes if they suddenly start receiving saline injections instead." Again, I don't think this would apply directly to the epilepsy study, but you could imagine it applying to other studies. But then the primary explanation favored by Anthes in this article is something called the caregiver placebo effect, or the placebo effect by proxy. And this one's pretty straightforward when you think about it. Animals can't report or explain their own symptoms. Understanding the symptoms experienced by an animal, whether that's something like a seizure or whether it's something even more elusive like discomfort or pain, that requires human observation of some kind, usually reports by the pet owners. And the pet owner absolutely can form expectations about improvement based on believing that their pet is getting a treatment of some kind, even though their pet might actually be in the placebo arm of the study. They don't know that if it's a well-designed study. So they think their pet might be receiving the actual drug. They form expectations that the pet will be getting better, and thus they interpret everything they see in light of those expectations. Because again, seizure frequency in the study in question was measured by owner reports. And you might imagine, well, okay, you know, it's pretty clear whether a dog is having a seizure or not. Well, you might assume that, but in fact, pet owners are not always there to see a seizure take place. Sometimes you have to interpret ambiguous evidence. So the example given in the article is if there's a spot of saliva on the floor, is that a sign that the dog had a seizure unobserved and drooled on the floor? Or is that just nothing? Did the dog just drip drool because they just drip drool? If the owners believe their dogs are receiving a drug that will help reduce the seizures, does that actually make the owner less likely to interpret that evidence as evidence of a seizure?
Yeah, okay. I see what you're talking about here. Okay. Like, he's on the medicine, so I guess that's not a seizure drool. That's just drool.
Yeah. The article also cites a veterinary surgeon at the University of Minnesota named Michael Konzemius, who gives a really interesting example from a different study. This was a study on anti-inflammatory treatments for arthritis in dogs. And they did a trial that involved both subjective and objective measurements of how well this anti-inflammatory was doing to reduce arthritic pain in the limbs. And so the subjective measure was you would ask both pet owners and veterinarians to observe the dog and rate how much pain they seemed to be in. And then there were also objective measures, and this would be having the dog walk on a complicated setup of digital scales to determine how much weight the dogs were putting on each limb while walking. Because if one of the dog's limbs is in pain, they will tend to put less weight on that limb. And this study found conflicts between the subjective measures and the objective measures. So in the placebo group, owners and vets who thought the dog might be receiving the drug, but actually they were just getting a placebo, reported improvements. But the objective measure, the scales, did not show improvement. So in the placebo group, they're getting a fake treatment. The owners and the veterinarians are like, yeah, we think the dog is doing better. But when you put them on the scales, they're still not putting weight on that limb. So the dog itself is not affected by receiving the placebo, but the human observers are. Interestingly, even the veterinarians.
This is interesting because when we first raised the question about placebo effect in animals, and then when you brought up dogs here, my first thought was, well, dogs are highly social animals.
Yeah.
And so perhaps there is some sort of social dynamic between the way their human is treating them. Like maybe
yeah.
it has to do, maybe it has to do with pill pockets. Like, oh, I'm getting more snacks or I'm getting more attention or something like that. And then that, of course, would be something that would not seem to readily translate into the livestock world. But what we're looking at here, these are examples that, if I'm not mistaken, would translate rather readily into the world of caring for livestock.
Yeah, because it's about the human observers, like the cow, whatever is making it into these reports that are in like anthropological texts or, you know, folklore journals or whatever. The cow doesn't actually get to write that report. That's made by humans. And it's usually going to be like the farmer saying, yeah, my cow got better or something like that. And they could well be affected by caregiver placebo effect. They form expectations of efficacy and they interpret what they see through that lens. Another thing is that this article reports how sometimes animal pain is observable to one human onlooker, but not to another. Again, just based on expectations, like our emotional biases are very strong in this area. And one example given would be, a pet owner brings an animal into the vet and it was in pain before. And the vet observes that the animal does still appear to be in pain. But the owner says, no, he's not. He's much better now. I've been giving him these homeopathic treatments I found. And, you know, that's a mix of things like the pet owner, they love their pet. So they desire to believe that the beloved animal is doing better. And then on top of that, you could have like a choice supportive bias to, you know, where you interpret reality in a way that supports the idea that what you have decided to do was the right decision. So the choice supportive bias says your selected intervention is working, and that may be a magical treatment or a non-science-based intervention like homeopathy or something. And that can blind you to signs of distress that other unbiased onlookers could see.
Yeah, because at least you feel like you're doing something in those cases, and or you're a consultant. You may be consulting experts in the local community that are also assuring you, like, yeah, this is the way to go. This is what will get results.
Yeah, and I think the important thing to stress here is that this occurs. You don't have to be like an uncaring, you know, companion to your non-human animal of whatever type it is. Like you can care very much about their well-being and have this kind of bias. It's not like a result of being cold and unfeeling and cruel. So just a couple final notes on this article. One is just that a big takeaway is you should be careful when observing the symptoms of a non-human animal, of a pet or whatever, not to let these kinds of biases prevent you from finding the most effective treatment or solution. You know, whenever possible, try to look for objective pieces of behavioral evidence that remove your subjective evaluation from things. And then the other thing is about the standards of evidence within veterinary medicine. Unfortunately, the history of veterinary studies has included fewer double-blind placebo-controlled trials than human medicine, because again, for a long time, nobody really thought placebo effect would come into play in a major way in veterinary medicine, but it looks like at least in some cases it really does, especially when the reported outcomes are based on owners' perceptions. And so this is changing, and more evidentiary standards like this are being introduced into veterinary medicine, but it may mean that the evaluation of the true efficacy of veterinary medicine has, in some cases, especially when the basis is older, maybe on a lower standard of evidence than in human drug trials. But fortunately, that is changing. But anyway, so I'm bringing all this back to thoughts about how this could relate to like a Scottish farmer in the 17th century who believes that his cow is sick or his horse is sick because it has been elf shot. It has been, you know, hit by a fairy arrow, and summons someone to provide a magical cure that maybe involves Neolithic flints or egg mixed with gunpowder and healing their cow. I wonder how it relates to that. I mean, I would guess that the specifically that last one, the caregiver placebo effect, would be a major factor here.
Yeah, I think so. That seems to be that would seem to be the key.
Though it also makes me wonder about the idea of an inverse thing. This is not addressed in the article at all, but a caregiver nocebo effect. I mean, it makes me wonder how you could have anxieties or beliefs about danger, other kinds of things taking place purely within the mind of the animal caregiver that give rise to spurious diagnoses of illness or symptoms in the animal. Like, what if actually the cow is fine? The farmer just gets freaked out about the idea that, oh no, something bad is happening to my cow for some reason. And that brings on the illusion of distress, which could then be treated by some kind of magical intervention. And then what do you know, the cow's fine afterwards.
Yeah, this is especially possible given some of the linked or perceived to be linked activities to elf shot, like the cases where humans did something they shouldn't have to attract the attention of the elves, be it, you know, tromping on sacred ground, cutting down of a sacred tree, or something of this nature. Or even just the finding of the elf arrow. Like, you know, this was curious. I was out with my cattle and I found this artifact on the ground. It's clearly an artifact of the elves. I better check on my cattle and see how they're doing. This one's not doing too well.
Oh, yeah. I didn't make that connection with the picking up of the flint, but yeah, that makes sense.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, there was a paper we talked about a little bit in the previous episode that I wanted to come back to and just mention a couple of more interesting little stories from. It was that paper called Elfshot Cattle by Thomas Davidson that was published in the journal Antiquity in 1956. Remember, this is the one that was collecting a lot of those reports about Elfshot.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that caught my attention was the claim that a lot of times these injuries from Elfshot are not inflicted directly by fairies or elves themselves. Davidson cites an author named Louide writing that there's a belief among some that fairies have to use humans as intermediaries in order to inflict these injuries, since the fairies have little power to cause direct physical injury to animal bodies themselves. So sometimes these stories say humans are like sucked up into the air by fairies and then given fairy weapons and then forced to shoot at men or cattle.
So, yeah, okay. So sort of possession going on here.
Yeah, one example of this is a story called The Tale of Black Donald of the Fairy Throng. And this is a story where there's this guy named Donald and he's out plowing. He's plowing the land. He's working in the furrows. And this is on the Isle of Tiree, which is off the coast of Scotland. And Donald, he's plowing, and he gets sucked up by a fairy convoy. And then they force him to drop an arrow from the sky that kills a speckled cow. And this actually connects with some of the critical stuff I was reading about the Elfshot tradition, which says that actually in a lot of these stories, it is being alleged that it's humans who are doing the inflicting, like witches or something, who are inflicting damage with these weapons rather than elves directly.
Interesting. And it gets into a common trope in many cultures of the outsider within, somebody within the community, either somebody from outside the community or somebody within the community that has been corrupted somehow.
One thing I had to mention just because it was funny, there's a long section of this paper that talks about alleged cures for Elfshot, and one is a recorded anecdote of a wise woman curing a cow in the Shetlands by asking the crofter, the farmer, to bring her a Bible. And he brings the Bible, and she rips pages out of the Bible and balls them up into a pellet, and then crams the Bible page pellet into a dimple in the cow's skin. Then there's another one I have to share because it involves crabs and it raises a mystery for me that I cannot solve. So maybe the listeners have some input on this. So this is from a source Davidson cites called Shetland Folklore. This is a book by Spence. And I'm going to read directly from Davidson's summary here. Oh, and sorry, this is still about traditions in the Shetlands. Quote, a variant prescription from the same area directs the wise woman to take tar, a needle, a Bible, a firebrand, and some fairy crabs. Waving the burning brand, she walked three times Widdershins round the cow. That means counterclockwise. Three times Widdershins round the cow, jabbing the animal with the needle, waving a leaf of the Bible over its back, and muttering an incantation. The firebrand was placed in a pot of tar and set at the cow's head so the fumes would make her cough. She was then given the fairy crabs to eat alive. The ashes of the firebrand were later mixed with the tar into three pills, which were administered to the animal on three successive mornings.
Whoa.
What? So it involves eating the fairy crabs alive. It says she, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure if that means the cow or the wise woman. I think that means the cow.
Yeah, I remember reading this in the source during the initial research phase, and I could not figure out what fairy crabs were. I was like, my mind was struggling to form. I was just imagining like a glowing blue crab.
I was confused too, and I tried to look this up. There is an animal called a fairy crab. You can see it if you Google that phrase, but it's clearly not what this is referring to, because it's a species of squat lobster called, the scientific name is Loria siagiani, and it's native to the Pacific. It's found like off the coast of Australia and Indonesia, I think. So this is clearly not what they're talking about in the Shetlands. And I was trying to find more information and I just could not. So I wonder if this refers to, I don't know if this is a local Shetland name for a certain type of animal, like an actual crab or some type of insect or something. I really have no idea.
Yeah, I can imagine it going in different directions. Some sort of novel crab that's found on the shore or turned up in nets or indeed something that is found in streams, or is not a crab at all, but some sort of an insect with some sort of folk medicine properties to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, certainly we have examples in plenty of cultures where if something is named after an animal, but is not itself an animal, it could be, you could imagine a situation where the fairy crab is actually some sort of a root, something to that effect. So there's so many different directions it could go in, not knowing exactly what this is referring to.
Well, hey, listeners, if you got insight on this, you know what the fairy crabs are, write in. One last subject that Davidson brings up with respect to elf shot is the idea of curved plow furrows and ridges in order to, quote, wander the fairy, which I found so interesting. It's the idea that if you go throughout Scotland and you look at some old cultivated fields, you'll find that, these places that are they're dug with what's known as like a ridge and furrow system.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a series of basically, lines where like you'd have a plowed area and then like a sort of ridge of moved earth piled up in between them. And an interesting thing about a lot of these is they're created with so that the ridges and the furrows are not straight lines, but are curved or crooked or S-shaped even. And it is believed by some that the purpose of this is to confuse or, quote, wander the fairy, to maybe lead the fairy off course or lead the elf off course. This is not the only system, by the way, that would use this. Like Davidson notes that a lot of amulets that are designed for protection against fairies have arrays of kind of spiral patterns or complex whorls within them or labyrinths or something. And this is designed to confuse the evil spirits, to kind of send them on a maze-like journey that will lead them astray and keep them from harming you.
If you haven't seen these ridge and furrow features, definitely look them up and do an image search, because you can see lots of wonderful aerial photographs of this sort of thing. And yeah, you can sort of imagine the trail of the elf going astray here.
Some of the ones you're looking at are the curved ones, because some are just straight, but others are curved.
Yeah, some are just straight, but I was looking at one in particular here where you do see, you kind of see a mix in this particular one. You see the different areas of land and definite curves in some areas, where and one kind of has like almost like a fern look, because you have the line going down the middle, and then you have some like different wavings on each side.
So the magical understanding here, again, is that this well, it could throw fairies off just generally because, you know, you make twisting paths in order to confuse evil spirits. But the other thing would be it doesn't allow them to get a clear straight line shot at the cattle, like at the oxen mm-hmm. that you're using to plow the field.
Yeah, this is strange. Like this idea of the elf is kind of like this. You know, I guess you look at different folklore systems. It's like you want to avoid doing things that draw attention to yourself. You know, we definitely see that with elf and fairy folk traditions in this part of the world with the wearing of green, which we've discussed before. Don't wear the green. That's the color of the elves or the fairies. They'll come at you. You also see that with traditions of the evil eye in the Middle East, where there are various things like you should not do because this invisible nefarious force is out there in the world. And you do not want it aware of your presence or your fortune. So you don't get on its radar. Don't have direct lines leading to you. Be that line something like, you know, you shouting about how beautiful your child is. You know, in the case of some of the evil eye traditions, particularly in Judaism, I remember reading about, or in this case, like a physical line through the altered landscape.
I think this type of belief is still present even in like modern day Christianity. Like I remember when I was a kid hearing about the dangers of playing with a Ouija board, and the idea was it attracts demonic attention. I mean, that's literally like it's like when you play with a Ouija board, it's not so much something about the board is evil, but it sort of like puts up a beacon to demons that says, hey, I'm available, you know, pay attention to me, and they will hone in on you because you have done that.
Yeah. Oh, and quick note, I mentioned Judaism and the evil eye and so forth. The evil eye is not necessarily like a part of Judaism. I don't want to imply that, but it is something that is sort of in the folkloric traditions of various peoples in the Middle East, including you'll see that in Judaic culture.
Yeah.
And certainly we see similar case with this here, because we have peoples we're discussing that have taken, that have converted to Christianity, but they're still practicing beliefs. They're still engaging in belief of the elves, but they're also incorporating in some of these Christian traditions. Like, well, maybe we're, you know, wad up a Bible page and stick it into that furrow in the cow, and that'll help too.
This next thing is not really addressed in Davidson, but I was wondering about this because I was reading about the ridge and furrow system elsewhere after reading this passage from Davidson, and it seems to me that sometimes the strips that are plowed in this system are curved for totally mundane reasons that have nothing to do with magical beliefs. I think that they're often curved just because of it was a sort of necessary consequence of the types of plow rigging and oxen pulling teams that they used at the time. They would lead to a furrow or a ridge being kind of like curved off at each end every time the team turned around to make a new line. And that makes me wonder if something like twisting in these rows could have originally been a totally mundane thing that somebody saw, and then in trying to explain why it was like that without understanding it, they came up with this explanation about confusing the fairies, and then afterwards did it like that on purpose.
So it's like somebody like the landowner or whoever comes out to check on the work and is like, Dale, what's going on with these ridges and furrows? Look at it. It's just like, I can tell it's crooked. And Dale's like, well, do you want the fairies coming straight at you? I didn't think so. You're welcome. This, of course, also reminds me of, on one hand, this may well be connected, the idea that vampires might be deterred by hanging some sort of a knotted item or carefully woven item out for them, like a complex pattern that will draw their attention and they have to deal with. And maybe they'll either spend all their time doing that and leave you alone, or perhaps they'll even get caught in the sunlight. They'll lose track of time. And then, of course, I can't help but think of crop circles as well, which, again, as we've discussed, I think we've discussed this on the show before. I mean, crop circles pretty much put to bed as the work of human actors. But thinking about like sort of the draw to do this to a field, like the human intention to do this. And there are several factors that can play into that, some of which may actually come up in our next episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. But the idea of like just seeing that field, like I wonder if there's some sort of draw that like, no, the lines are too perfect. Everything is just too pristine. Like this land has been too finely transformed. We got to get some swirls in there. We got to get some circles, you know?
That is a good comparison. I didn't think you were going to crop circles, though. I thought you were going to mention the Jiangxi being warded off by spilling glutinous rice on the floor, because I think they'll be counting the grains, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good point as well. I'd forgotten about that one. Something about, yeah, the inhuman analytical mind of the non-human beings in folklore, and that they can be led astray by either randomized patterns or things of human creation that have some sort of elegance to them. Which is kind of ironic, given that we're talking about situations where human beings may, in some cases, have just like completely flipped their wig over finding an old flint arrow in the dirt. So I guess it cuts both ways.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Now, there's one more paper I wanted to briefly mention that gets way more into the weeds about a particular text that is believed or has been believed to reference Elfshot. But I thought this was interesting, too. So this was a paper by a professor of English at the University of Leeds named Alaric Hall called Calling the Shots, the Old English Remedy, Gifhors of Scotten Sea and Anglo-Saxon Elfshot, published in 2005. So this paper is mainly an attempt to critically re-examine an Anglo-Saxon text called Gifhors of Scotten Sea, which is a passage from a medieval Anglo-Saxon medical text that has been widely interpreted as being about elf shot. The title, Gifhors of Scotten Sea, translates to if a horse be, and then the word is of Scotten, and the question is, what does of Scotten mean? It's been traditionally translated as elf shot, if a horse be elf shot. Hall argues that it should not be understood that way, and yet there are still references to elf attacks within the passage. So this is Hall's translation of this text, which is interesting in itself. If a horse be ofscotten, take then a dagger whose haft is of fallow ox's horn, and in which there are three brass nails. And then there's a term that every time is rendered as write slash inscribe. I'm just going to say inscribe.
Okay.
Inscribe on the horse, on the forehead, Christ's mark, so it bleeds. Inscribe then Christ's mark on the spine and on each of the limbs which you can grasp. This shall you do. Take a staff, strike on the back, then the horse will be well. And inscribe on the dagger's handle these words, Benedicite omnia opera Domini Dominum, which means bless all the works of the Lord of Lords. Should it be Alphs which is on it, this will do as a remedy for it. And so Hall makes the argument in this paper that the primary condition being described in this text under the word ofscotten should not be translated as elf shot as it traditionally has been, but it's something like badly pained. It's a more mundane condition that is prompting this entire remedy. However, even if that's correct, the last line of the remedy does mention the idea of this word alf, the A-E combined vowel and then L-F-E. Though this sentence is also kind of difficult to translate, the one that's got the alf in it. I think the understanding that makes the most sense is this whole remedy is for regular bad pain in horses. And then there's an additional remedy, the one that's writing on the dagger's handle the words, bless all the works of the Lord of Lords. That additional remedy is like a special extra dose of holiness that should be applied if the cause of the horse's pain is injury by an elf, though it doesn't explain how you tell the difference between normal bad pain and bad pain caused by an elf. You know, of course, the elf injury being even more unholy and requiring more holiness or more piety in order to undo.
Either way you shake it, from a modern perspective, it's a lot of cutting and striking of a pained horse.
Yeah, geez. You feel bad for the horse.
Yeah. Now, as we go to close out this look at elf shot, I did want to come back to some basic questions, some of which we've already got into, concerning the archaeology of elf shot. Who were the people who made these artifacts, and how did they get to the regions where the artifacts were found, and then, of course, you know, interpreted and reinterpreted within these folkloric traditions? This, of course, is a broad question because, as we've mentioned already, we're talking about multiple areas. We're talking about locations throughout the British Isles and even outside of the British Isles. But just limiting the question to the British Isles, we're still looking at close to 1 million years of occupation by various human species, including Neanderthals. And as for the how they got there, the predominant theories involve land bridges between Europe and Britain that were present at the time. And regarding Ireland, I've seen hypotheses that involve boats, land bridges, and also ice bridges.
Mm-hmm.
But just to give a few examples that really sort of drive home the time we're talking about here, there are stone tool and footprints in Norfolk that date back an estimated 900,000 years. And these would be the work and or the footprints of Homo antecessor. Notable here are the Happisburg footprints in Norfolk, and also a black flint hand axe was also found in this area. So the Homo antecessor, they were makers of simple stone tools, and it looks like many experts think that they might not have had mastery of fire.
Hmm.
By 4000 BCE, a Neolithic culture was firmly established on the British Isles and lasted till roughly, this is just, you know, the rough time period of our histories, 2500 BCE. And of course, between 3000 BCE and 2000 BCE, we see the construction of Stonehenge, one, of course, the most famous, if not the most famous testament to prehistoric Britain. And of course, even Stonehenge gets wrapped up into various folklore traditions and folkloric interpretations and reinterpretations that involve at times the wizard Merlin, but also the Christian devil. And even during the Roman period, which would have been roughly 43 CE to 410 CE, the Roman sky god Calus. More realistically, or more on the sort of realistic interpretation and reinterpretation standpoint, it was at one point thought to be credited to the work of Druidic culture, but this culture didn't exist till 300 BCE, which would have been too late. So the stones were already ancient history to the Druids.
Mm.
Now, another example that I found really interesting of talking about found arrowheads in the British Isles. In 2016, archaeologists from the University of Reading discovered a 4,500-year-old flint arrowhead a few miles from Stonehenge. And according to David Dawson, director of the Wiltshire Museum, this particular arrowhead is not only finely preserved, but incredibly fragile, suggesting that it was never actually intended for use in war or hunting, but was rather ceremonial or decorative and or decorative. You can look up images of this. There were some news articles at the time. The arrowhead was unearthed in two parts, two different digs, 5 years apart. And it is quite elegant looking. It has barbs, but one really long barb, an elongated barb on one side. So I don't know about you, but I find that really interesting because I think it's easy to think of folkloric interpretation of found objects to be a luxury of later civilizations on the British Isles, to think supernaturally about these items. But certainly there's a lot we don't know about concerning pre-Roman and prehistoric Britain. But even 4,500 years ago, this find would suggest that people here were already capable of sublime interpretations and perhaps mystical meanings for their own created artifacts. That you could have this sacred arrow that wasn't found, that was made, but some of the same energy that goes into the interpretation of these artifacts, thousands of years later, was already present in the cultures that made their home here.
Right. And so we don't know what it would have been used for, but it's clear that it would not have been useful for actual shooting of an arrow. So,
right.
It could be decorative. It could be medicinal, some kind of amulet. It could be magical or ceremonial. We don't know. But in any case, it would be a symbolic arrowhead rather than one used for the literal, direct, mundane purpose.
Yeah. And so you can imagine at some point in history, after this point, if someone were to find an arrowhead like this, especially, I mean, any arrowhead, obviously, any kind of novel lump of stone could find itself interpreted as an elf arrow and incorporated into elf shot folklore. But imagine if you found this, clearly an arrow that looks too fine to be shot, that's almost ephemeral in its construction. Like, who would make this? Why would they make this? Clearly, this is the work of the elves. But also, I think it's just, it's just worth remembering the deep history of people on the British Isles. It might not be as deep as some other areas. You're looking at in France, I think it's 1.57 million years ago, we have some of the earliest known evidence of human beings. But still, you have human species on the British Isles, as early as almost a million years ago. Different species, different cultures, different waves of technology and arrivals in the subsequent centuries and millennia, and of course, different waves of interpretation and reinterpretation of what came before.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close it out there, but obviously we'd love to hear from everyone out there. We'd especially love to hear from folks listening to the show on the British Isles, or folks who have spent time on the British Isles. Perhaps you have some tidbits, some local lore to share with us. If so, we'd love to hear from you. A reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast that publishes on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. But on Mondays, we do a listener mail episode where we read various missives from our listeners. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact. On Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.